This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Childcare is getting more affordable thanks to changing income guidelines for state help.
This is a good news for those who are in the middle income level that they couldn't really send their kids to the high end.
Early childhood expert Miranda Lynn of ISU has more in Ryan Denham's report. Plus, Eric Stock reports on a growing concern over the effect of travel sports on kids and their families. Patrick Murphy and Mike McCurdy look at an effort to recreate a small patch of savanna in Bloomington Normal. Tim Shelley takes us to the place that perhaps most values the famed sculptor Laredo Taft. And John Norton reports on how mismanagement and grinding it out on the road broke up a family musical group and led to a solo effort for Danielle Nicole. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Here's something you don't hear every day. Child care in Illinois just got more affordable. Years after a sharp decline in enrollment, the state is now investing more money into the Child Care Assistance Program, which helps low and moderate income families. Income eligibility limits are being relaxed, maximum copays are being lowered, and the state has earmarked more money to train and pay child care workers, a notoriously underpaid profession. WGLT's Ryan Denham has more.
The Illinois Department of Human Services is investing $32 million in new money into child care. Human Services Secretary Grace Ho says they hope to increase enrollment in the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, by 20,000 children by next summer.
And we think it's a worthwhile investment for the state.
Child care experts across Illinois call these good first steps, in contrast to how neglected CCAP became in recent years. In 2015, former Governor Bruce Rauner's administration significantly lowered the maximum income that a family could make to qualify for CCAP. That only lasted a few months, but the program lost over 30,000 families as a result. That's according to Maria Whalen, president and CEO for the Chicago-based Illinois Action for Children.
Even though most of those eligibility restrictions were rescinded, the program really did not bounce back.
Dan Harris says that move in 2015 created a rip in the trust between parents and the program. Harris is the executive director of the Illinois Network of Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies, or INCRA, which includes 16 local agencies around the state.
There still, remains some distrust and confusion about how the program might work. And so I think the current administration's efforts to do outreach and communication around, hey, see the child, you may be eligible for the child care subsidy program, is a step towards rebuilding some of the trust and understanding of how the program really is a benefit. It really can help.
So here are the three biggest changes. First, families can make up to 200% of the federal poverty limit and still qualify to join CCAP. So a family of three can make up to $42,000 a year and still qualify. That's up from $39,000 before. Secondly, the parents in CCAP are required to help pay for the cost of the child care. But now that maximum copay has been reduced from over 11% of a family's income down to 9%. And third, families now only have to get reapproved for CCAP once a year instead of every 6 months. That went into effect last year. Dan Harris says the increased eligibility, while modest, will make a difference. He says parents in CCAP tended to clump at the upper end of the income eligibility scale.
So raising the upper income threshold will sort of release that bubble a little bit, if you will, and allow people to make more money on their own and still maintain their subsidy level. And that's important because, as we all know, child care is incredibly expensive.
So how expensive? Well, in Illinois, a family looking to send an infant to a child care center, which is usually the most expensive option, on average pays about $250 a week. That's according to Child Care Aware of America. That falls down to about $160 per week for home-based care. Miranda Lynn is an early childhood expert at Illinois State University's College of Education. She says now is a good time for parents who previously did not qualify for CCAP to go ahead and plug in their household income into the Department of Human Services eligibility calculator.
So those who are not qualified before, maybe now they are qualified. This is a good news for those who are in the middle income level that they couldn't really send their kids to the high-end private sectors, but then now they may be able to send their kids to a center that get the state subsidized.
The drop in maximum copays, even by a few percentage points, is significant for families. That's according to Carrie Byers, assistant director for the Illinois Policy Team at the OUNCE, which advocates for children in their first 5 years. She says that drop to 9% will mean around $500 in annual savings for families on the highest end of eligibility.
Families have so many, you know, hard fixed costs, and anything that we can do to bring that out-of-pocket cost down for child care is going to be important.
Byers says the ideal copay would be no more than 7% of a family's income. Regardless, none of these changes matter if the families don't know about CCAP to begin with. And that's been a problem. The Department of Human Services says just 34% of eligible family members in Illinois participated in CCAP in 2017. And that's down from 56% at the program's height back in 2004. Secretary Grace Ho says her department is leading a very aggressive marketing program to make sure more parents are aware that help is available. There have been new flyers, new letters, and a new Facebook page for CCAP, all launched recently.
It is our job at the Department of Human Services to make sure that our programs are accessible, available, and known to the eligible participants. And I think that there have been a variety of reasons why parents have not participated, and we want to address those very forthrightly.
Around 131,000 children are enrolled in CCAP in McLean, Livingston, DeWitt, Logan, Tazewell, Woodford, and Peoria counties. Each family in those places receives, on average, around $750 per month in CCAP subsidy. Katie's Kids has two child care learning centers in Bloomington Normal. Owner Katie Stelmarta says around 10% of her kids are enrolled in CCAP.
I definitely am sharing this more with our families because I do realize that there may be some that are just at that brink of not quite qualifying before and that might qualify now, and any kind of assistance to help in child care is just so pivotal for families because child care is expensive.
Stelmarta says she's also encouraged by the state putting more money toward bolstering the high-churn, low-pay child care workforce. Starting this year, the state has doubled its investment in a scholarship program that pays a portion of tuition for eligible professionals working in early care and education or school-age programs. The state is also opening up a program called Great Start to more people that supplements the wages for those working in child care.
I think we're definitely making strides in the right direction, and I'm anxious to see kind of how this continues to evolve. It's just great to see that early childhood is really being valued and in our community and in our state and as a society as a whole.
While these may be good first steps, childcare experts say there's more to do. Carrie Byers with the OUNCE says reimbursement rates should be next. She says the amount of money that providers actually get from the state often lags the actual cost of childcare. In McLean County, for example, a state survey shows the CCAP subsidy would allow parents to access just 13% of infant and toddler spots in those more expensive licensed childcare centers. That leads to more parents placing their kids in home-based care.
We know that compensation is a huge issue in addressing our workforce challenges in early childhood, and raising those rates in the child care assistance program that go to providers will certainly go a long way.
Katie Stelmartis from Katie's Kids says the state could also do some smaller things for providers, like waiving or offsetting somehow the cost of CPR and first aid training, $65 apiece, or the cost of applying for certain early childhood professional credentials, which is another $65.
And that's really huge for us as a small business to be investing those dollars for our staff when there is inevitably some turnover because we're in a college community. So we have staff that sometimes work with us for one semester at a time.
Child care may also become an issue during the Democratic presidential primary and general election in 2020. At least six Democratic candidates have said they support federal comprehensive child care plans that would address cost, availability, and provider pay. Secretary Ho says it's important to think of child care assistance as a workforce development tool.
I think it's a great asset that employers in different parts of Illinois also benefit from, and that their employees have stable, affordable child care.
Ho says this is just phase one of the rebuild of CCAP. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find a link to the Illinois Department of Human Services eligibility calculator at our website, wglt.org.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a few minutes on 89.1 and WGLT.org, the works of Laredo Taft and where they are most appreciated. Fewer high school students in Illinois are playing sports for their school, but the number of youth playing club sports for travel teams and other for-profit organizations has been on the rise. That prompted the head of the National Federation of State High School Associations, Carissa Niehoff, to publish an online editorial slamming travel sports, saying they're often costly for families and sometimes make unrealistic promises of athletic success. Assistant Executive Director for the Illinois High School Association, Matt Troa, tells WGLT's Eric Stock the association shares much of the national group's concerns.
You know, I think some of the language they use in their release is probably a little stronger maybe than maybe we feel. But I think it also varies kind of on a sport-by-sport basis. There's a lot of travel or non-school sports, as we kind of like to call them within our bylaws, that have, I think, a very symbiotic relationship with the IHSA season. A lot of those sports, not all student athletes are going to be two and three sport athletes, and it gives them an outlet to continue to prepare and hone their skills and potentially look for the next level. And so we understand their purpose, and I think it serves it in a lot of those cases. But there are others where we compete in some sports, for the same student athletes at the same time. And obviously, in those instances, we feel very strongly about the high school experience, the education-based athletics being a better path in that regard. And then in other areas, I think that some of those lines are beginning to get blurred a little bit. And the more we deal with specialization and overuse injuries, there's a potential that those will maybe potentially butt heads more in the future. But I'd say it's kind of a mixed bag across the board.
Well, the report that came out from the NFSA executive director, it references travel costs, several thousand dollars a year for these travel teams. One in five parents, it says, are spending $1,000 a month on fees, uniforms, travel, food, etc. for these travel programs. Do you feel that some parents go into this maybe not realizing how much it costs?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. I also think that, in some cases, it's just not maybe being as well educated on, for so many folks, if the goal is, a college scholarship or the opportunity to play in college, which I think it is for a lot of people, I think in some cases, this message kind of just gets spoken into truth that you have to do this or you have to do that in order to make it to that next level. And, I think in a lot of cases, you have to take into consideration that that a lot of the people telling you that are making money off of you to do that. So I think, from a parent's perspective, you got to educate yourself. Not only on what you got to establish what your goals are, educate yourself on how to get to there, and then educate yourself on that particular team, because that's not the case. We don't want to vilify all travel or non-school teams, because there are a lot of them offering great opportunities with great coaching, good kids and parents. Overall, a great experience and not necessarily for an outstanding or tremendous cost. You can certainly get caught in that trap, I think, if you don't know what you're looking for.
Could it be in some cases that some of these travel teams are deceiving parents, suggesting that they're promising athletic stardom that's likely not going to happen, or at least won't make for all the money that they're putting into the program?
Yeah, I think we hear a lot of horror stories at our office about those kind of things. And, you also hear the opposite sort of that of you have to come play on my travel team if you want to play on the high school team, because I have a hand in both. And, we have rules against that, but there are gray areas and things that can be tough to enforce. So, I think that there's probably some misinformation out there in some cases. But as I said, I think there's probably a lot of people doing the right thing as well.
Well, and you have schools under the umbrella of the Illinois High School Association, which is, what, 900 or so, more than that?
Yeah, a little over 800, yep.
Travel sports, there maybe isn't one sort of governing body to oversee all of them and to provide a sort of supervision, as it were, and rules and guidelines to follow. Does that complicate matters to a degree where you might have, you know, as you're suggesting, maybe there are some outliers that are, you know, that are bad actors. Is that kind of contributing to that?
You know, I think it does. And as I said, it kind of differs from sport to sport. And that makes me think a little bit about baseball. The high school baseball season is very short, especially in Illinois, where, you know, the beginning of the season can be shortened due to weather. And, you know, we've put in a lot of restrictions in place on coaches on the number of pitches kids can throw and how much rest they have to have. And, you know, I think our coaches, for the most part, were happy to do that. But in a lot of the initial pushback from them when those occurred was, you know, we take care of our kids. You know, we're on that conservative side with them. And it's the fact that then we hand them off in May or June and they can go pitch, you know, 1,000 times for someone else. And they may not be monitoring them, and they may not be putting their safety first. So, you know, they've expressed some frustration in that regard that speaks to your point. There isn't necessarily a governing body out there when you get into that non-school or that travel team, and you're sort of just left to hoping that your coach is educated and doing the right things.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Matt Troha, who is an assistant executive director for the Illinois High School Association, as we're discussing the impact that travel sports is having on our sports economy, if you will. And as we've talked about, these travel teams can take up a lot of a child's time and attention, and then it can lead to specialization, kids only playing one sport, and maybe leads to unrealistic expectations. It also could potentially lead to repetitive use injuries. How much of a concern is that?
Well, I'm glad you touched on that. I think that's becoming more and more of a concern. We're starting to see more studies at a national level that are showing, you know, the dangers, I think, of specialization. Specialization and overuse, I think, tend to go hand in hand. Really an interesting report out of had to do with several NBA teams and their team doctors, and just kind of the rash of injuries amongst, you know, younger players in the NBA. And just there's a lot of quotes in there from those folks kind of just talking about how underdeveloped a lot of the athlete is in terms of muscles and things like that in different areas, and then how overextended they are in the ones that they use in basketball. So, you know, I think we're seeing those two things go hand in hand, that as kids choose to specialize, you know, it has the potential to hurt them as an athlete overall, that they gain not only the strength and the training for their entire body by playing other sports, but some of that skill as well that carries over. But then also that, you know, it's overall ends up just weakening a lot of those muscles that they overuse by only participating in that one sport.
And that may not just be a travel sport issue. That could simply be at the high school level, too, or at the you know, intermediate level.
Yeah, no, absolutely it could. And I think we're going to only continue to see more studies. I know there's a lot ongoing right now, and I think we're only going to see more data in the future that that kind of proves that point. And so that will be, I think that this discussion we're having here is only going to become more important and probably more heated on both sides as you know, those paths are kind of figured out and that data becomes available.
And as a representative of an association that runs and promotes high school sports, one might imagine the IHSA would see travel sports possibly as competition. How much has travel sports cut into participation in IHSA events?
You know, I think for the most part, in most team sports, you know, the travel season is carved out based upon the high school season. So there's not a lot of conflict. There are some sports, you know, soccer is one. Where we've sort of gone head-to-head in some cases where, you know, travel or non-school programs were adamant about, you know, trying to push kids to not play the high school game. I think that that's relented a little bit over the years. You know, we saw a lot of instances where kids would play travel for 3 years, gain a college scholarship, and then go play for their high school their senior year, which sort of showed us that, you know, they put more value in that experience of being on the high school team, but the scholarship or that next level part was very important to him. And so I think we're trying to push back a little bit on that as well, of the idea that you can only achieve that scholarship. And we've had some a positive step, I think, on basketball side over the last year. And the NCAA and the NFHS got together, and as you're aware, there's been a lot of things happening in college basketball, not in recruiting, and a lot of them not good in terms of this FBI investigation and
lack of institutional control. You're hearing that phrase come up a lot more.
Exactly. And so I think as a part of a result of that, the NFHS and the NCAA got together, and you know, the old sort of thinking was that, or the idea was that if you wanted to play college basketball, especially on the men's side, you have to play travel, AAU, whatever it is. That's where you earn your scholarship. And the NCAA and the NFHS got together last year, and they closed the window in the summer of when coaches could go out and watch kids play AAU. They made that smaller, and they opened up a big window for high school. And we hosted six team high school events here in Illinois, and where literally your high school team went, and all the college coaches could come watch them. And as a basketball fan, I thought there'd be a lot of pushback from college coaches on that. I thought they'd say, we need to see these kids playing the best of the best. But Joe Henrichsen from the Chicago Sun-Times quoted just a ton of coaches after those first few events, just anonymously, let them just kind of talk about how they felt. And the reaction was overwhelmingly positive, that they liked the idea of seeing kids play within a high school system, you know, within actual offenses and defenses. They liked the idea of seeing them be the best player on the court and have to take a leadership role. And ultimately, what we heard from some coaches, that there were kids who got noticed in those events that maybe weren't on the radar to be scholarship players that now are. So that kind of pushed back against that whole thinking of there's only one way, you know, in that particular sport to get a scholarship. And so I think that was a big positive in terms of for the high school game. And hopefully maybe that's something that we'll see carry over to some other sports as well.
And according to the NFHS website, which tracks participation across the country, most high school sports in Illinois are on the decline in participation. Some like baseball, softball, girls basketball are down over 10% over the last decade, football down 25%, and they're maybe other factors at play there. But is there a correlation between that and the rise of travel sports, especially when you factor in more students possibly playing just one sport?
You know, I think it's a piece of the puzzle, but I think it's a fairly small one. I'd probably guess that specialization is more of an issue. You know, our football issues are not unique to what's happening across the country, but we're able to sort of look at ours and know that a lot of the drops there come from Chicago, and a lot of Chicago public schools no longer offering the sport. So it's a lot of different factors. But I think specialization is probably the biggest one, where you used to see a lot of kids play at least two sports, some three sports, that there are a lot more of them that are now only involved in one. And I think you see that correlation in those numbers.
That was the Illinois High School Association's Matt Troha with WGLT's Eric Stock. The National High School Association notes less than 3% of high school football players will land an athletic scholarship to a Division I school. For basketball players, it's about 1%.
Mateel's sophomore album is called Satisfactory, and there's a wry sense of humor wrinkled throughout. She's a no-nonsense singer with a knack for smart lyrics and solid riffs. Mateel performs and talks about her new record on the next World Cafe.
It's World Cafe weeknights at 7 on Bloomington Normal's Public Media, WGLT.
Hear the top NPR and local GLT news stories handpicked just for you right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Patrick Murphy and Mike McCurdy try to delve into recreating grassland habitat in Bloomington Normal. That's in WGLT's gardening podcast, Grow. Cities large and small across Illinois proudly tout works of famed sculptor Laredo Taft. But as Tim Shelley tells us, the little town of Elmwood might cherish his art most of all.
Driving into Elmwood on Illinois Route 78, signs of the artist Laredo Taft are everywhere. There's a stately museum and a Victorian-era home on the main drag. A prominent statue celebrating America's pioneers that the Chicago-based artist made just for Elmwood stands proudly in the square. Taft was born in this western Peoria County community in 1860. Though the noted sculptor, writer, and speaker only lived here for the first 7 years of his life, it's clear Elmwood claims him as a native son. Taft is perhaps best known for big sculptures like the Fountain of Time in Chicago. But the Elmwood Historical Society cherishes a collection of smaller-scale works long hidden from public view. The story begins in 1984, when the Dayton, Ohio Art Institute contacted the Historical Society. Elmwood Historical Society President Fred Page says the museum wanted to divest of 9 dioramas it purchased from Taft Studios in the early 20th century.
Several members of the local historical society went over and brought those back over here. And they were stored in a garage here in town in 1985.
The dioramas gathered garage dust until the summer of 2010, when a tornado with 130-mile-per-hour winds swept through the city. The garage didn't fare well. But somehow the dioramas came out more or less unscathed. But they still needed serious restoration after decades in storage. A chance encounter with art conservationist Cricket Harbeck at a museum in Kenosha, Wisconsin last year led Historical Society members to recruit her for the effort. Harbeck says the dioramas were on display for about 15 years in Dayton during the heavy industrial era before they were packed away.
A lot of what we're picking up is black grime on the figures. But then, having been in the garage for a number of years, there's just even more grime accumulated.
The cleaning process is challenging. The wireframe statues are plastered and finished with oil-based paints. The cleaning agents used to wipe away the soot attack paint in different ways, depending on the colors.
One of the challenges is trying to clean things uniformly. So if I go to a blue area, to clean that as equally clean as the red area or the yellow area.
So far, she has finished work on 2 of the 9 dioramas and is working on a third. That also includes restoration of hundreds of figurines. She's completed about 60 so far. Fred Page of the Elmwood Historical Society says the hope is to have Taft's pieces ready for display for the Elmwood Christmas Walk on December 7th. Resident Mary Ann Hanlon sums up Elmwood's impression of its most famous citizen.
Everybody has to be born somewhere, but at first that didn't mean a whole lot to me. But then as I studied about him and realized how much he came back and gave to this community and gave to everyone else, that really brought significance of the fact that he considered Elmwood his home.
Heading out of Elmwood, a sign posted on Route 78 points the way to a granite stone on a quiet residential street, marking Laredo Taft's birthplace. Another solemn stone a few blocks away in the Elmwood Township Cemetery marks the spot he chose for his final resting place. I'm Tim Shelley.
Other notable sculptures by Laredo Taft include Lincoln the Lawyer in Urbana, a fountain of the Great Lakes at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Eternal Indian, also known as Chief Blackhawk, at Loudoun State Park in Oregon, Illinois, alma mater at the University of Illinois, and Taft created the Trotter Memorial Fountain in downtown Bloomington.
Support for WGLT's Grow comes from FS Farmtown by Evergreen FS. FS Farmtown is a resource for lawn and garden products, from power equipment to mower repair and maintenance and more. Details at evergreen-fs.com or at 1808 South Morrissey in Bloomington.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Tucked away near Cardinal Court on the Illinois State University campus are 18 acres designated for restoration. The goal, to return the area to original savanna state. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells WGLT's Mike McCurdy the area would be used for education and recreation.
In a small corner of Illinois State University's campus, graduate students and volunteers are working to restore an area to its original condition.
This is WGLT's Grow, your podcast source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. I'm Mike McCurdy. Patrick, thanks for stopping by for another edition of Grow.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So tell me about this area. Where is it? How big is it? What are we talking about?
This area is attached to ISU's campus on its north end. It's approximately 18 acres. It could be a little bit less than that if you kind of diced out some of the creek that runs through this property. The creek runs from the northernmost part of the boundary all the way to the south part of this savanna where it connects to the domesticated campus, actually near the men's ball field and University High School. There's also a local activity trail we all know as the Constitution Trail that could connect this area to other areas of interest that are nearby. The town of Normal has Fairview Park, ISU's Horticulture Center, all be part of that little network.
But speaking just from a biological standpoint, why this spot? There are probably many deserving areas. And so how is any area evaluated for a restoration area?
Well, in this case, it turns out in 1976, the Department of Biology, along with the help of Illinois State University leadership, dedicated this area for the purposes of outdoor study and an outdoor learning area. And if you go to this area today, parts of it are very difficult to even walk around because invasives have taken over part of it. But a little closer examination, you can see several plots of natives that have survived. There are a couple of other educational stations where the remnants are still there, but that is really all that is there. There's been a little bit of student activity in the last, say, 5 years.
So designating it sounds to me like it's better than doing nothing. At least you have the area sort of protected and not really doing anything on it. At least somebody is not doing something actively to destroy it.
It's a blessing for sure, and it's a great thing that a building hasn't popped up there. It's also important to preserve these natural spaces for study.
So what's the goal? You kind of talked about what condition it was already in. What's the goal?
The goal is to be able to allow the university first and the public second to be able to access the area and utilize it for the purposes of education, recreation, and also practice restoration techniques. Growing the plants that are needed for restoration are a big part of the puzzle. So that's the direction we'd like to see it go, and to have that level of inclusion and involvement leads one to develop access, because the access to this area is challenging right now. There's also very little for the visitor. There are no garbage cans, no picnic tables, nowhere to park your car close by, and there's no signage. There's no real demarcation of this area, so some of the basics could be practiced in this case, and it would be quite a bloom of development.
And what's happened so far? Has there been, you know, plants planted or recently, or just what about clearing out debris and garbage?
I've been here at the university for almost 6 years, and in the last 5 years, there have been a couple of independent study students and small student groups that have conducted some cleanups in this area. We did, in fall of 2018, have an independent study student that was very active. And he and I brought down a lot of invasive honeysuckle. And thank goodness we had the help of the good people at ISU Grounds to come and collect that debris and dispose of it properly. We've planted some native trees out there. We've made a map. We've inventoried what's there. And we've identified some opportunities to make enhancements that don't require a lot of outside involvement, but cleaning the creek up.
Sure. But you found evidence of positive use, too.
That's right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because the same independent study student from a year ago cleared a lot of hard debris out of this area, like old TVs. You know, I didn't know your TV would work back there, but apparently it did. And there was some camping debris. And the good sign that we came across was we found 3 footballs and over a dozen baseballs.
So people are using it for recreation.
Yeah. Yeah. They have some favor with it.
What goes into the restoration effort then?
Restoration efforts usually begin with the definition of the space, and that has definitely happened. I've had multiple students create the layout and a map to make a record of what's there now. And the university has sought the advice of firms that do restoration work. And that restoration work is not cheap. It's a lot more expensive than, say, routine landscaping is. and that cost was an impediment. So rather than having a big broad brush come through and fix everything, we've been doing it piece by piece, item by item, looking forward to the day that there's maybe a little more support to turn this area back into what it once represented, much more robust.
Is there an opportunity to do a burn there to clear out that area?
That is a great notion also, and the master student that's there now would have the option of developing that within the proper time constraints and maybe ask that student to secure a burn license, because that's something you can do as a restoration professional.
Because that would help maybe get rid of some of the invasives and benefit the natural plants that would be there.
It would help a lot. In the place of burning, there's also matting and bagging. Matting is where they put like a tarp down on the ground just to kill the vegetation that's there without disturbing the soil. They put in the proper plants, if you will, to create this balance of nature.
How far along is this restoration, and when will it be complete?
It's not very far along, and once some of the goals are met, say one goal could be to realize better access, the efforts will always be ongoing. But it's similar to like the bell curve when it comes to developing a landscape. The activity is highest in the beginning, and then after a crescendo is met, the property becomes a little bit more self-sustaining over time.
But there is ongoing maintenance, yes. Maybe forever.
Yes.
What are some challenges for this area?
The big challenge is that the creek is running through the middle of it. Vehicular and equipment access is limited. And it has some distribution network running through there. So there's an intersection of energized lines on power poles.
So overhead power lines.
Overhead power lines.
What kind of challenges does that present?
Well, those rights of way for those power lines have to be maintained by law, and they have to be maintained by the power company. But the power company, in general, let's say in a global aspect, have been very supportive of these types of efforts. And the master student that's working there now is in touch with the local energy cooperative that has been maintaining the lines in this area with the hope and goal of turning it into something that's similar to what's called the Great Western Trail in DuPage County, Illinois. That's up around, say, like St. Charles area. And Exelon Energy partnered with DuPage County and the towns in it, and they created this beautiful prairie restoration project, and it runs right under the lines and the towers in many places. So it's actually grateful that, in this case, the Corn Belt Energy and Ameren are in there doing the work that's needed to maintain those lines and keep those right-of-ways open. Those right-of-ways can also be used by the university in restoration efforts to get people and materials in and out of this savanna without disturbing the naturalized areas.
And how would you like to see this area used in the future?
I think it'd be great if the area had some benches and some seating, some things that make visiting it a little more easy to realize.
So not abandoned, but not quite user-friendly.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have some signs out there and a clear way to get in and out.
If you have any gardening or landscape questions or a favorite natural area, get in touch with us and tell us about it or ask your question, and we might talk about it on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Get this WGLT podcast and check out our others at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's not easy to recapture the magic of a family music group after touring exhaustion kills the joy and chemistry. Kansas City native Danielle Nicole has done that by changing her scene. She was part of the sibling blues band Trampled Underfoot that won the Blues Foundation International Blues Challenge in Memphis in 2008. The band went on to release four albums and tour extensively before falling apart. Nicole now has a solo career and two critically acclaimed albums under her name. The most recent received a Grammy nomination in the contemporary blues category. Nicole joins a slate of artists on the bill to play the MSA fundraiser at the Monarch Music Hall in Peoria tomorrow night. She tells WGLT's John Norton she did attend the Grammy Awards, but was a little surprised most of the awards were handed out earlier in the day in a building across from the Staples Center.
But we all walked the same red carpet to get in. You know, I walked the carpet around 12:30 in the afternoon, between 12:30 and 1, and then, you know, Lady Gaga was walking down it 4 or 5 hours later. I watched Brandi Carlile win her awards in the other building. They did have a few performances in between, but it's nowhere near the spectrum or size that the main event is.
You tell me you love me, you need me, just the same. But your heart's not ready to feel this way.
Our guest is Danielle Nicole. Cry No More is the name of the album you're hearing songs from, and this is WGLT's Sound Ideas. I think when we talked last time, it was you and your brothers had just called it quits with Trampled Underfoot, and you guys were talking about how it became more of a job, more of a business, and that really contributed to going in a different direction?
Yeah, it did. I mean, frankly, Chris quit the band, the middle brother, our drummer, he quit the band at the end of 13, and Nick and I had toured out 2014 with another drummer to kind of just, you know, give a farewell tour to our fans and family and friends that we had made over the years. But we just couldn't play together anymore. Yeah. We had lost sight of what our family was. We'd been mismanaged for a couple of years, and so we grinded a lot harder than we should have. And I think it really just, it took a toll on our relationship as a family, and we just couldn't, you know, we just couldn't do it. And 5 years later, we're doing better, but we did a few reunion shows, and I kind of pulled the plug on those. You know, it, for what it was a really beautiful, humongous chunk of my life. But I think in the end, Nick is happy where he's at with his band. And, you know, I'm definitely singing the whole show and playing the music I want to.
Well, did you tell him we got to break it up anyway because I got a Grammy nomination coming my way, you know? And
but I ain't gonna cry no more.
You mentioned that you guys were really grinded, and your manager was pushing you guys hard to get out there and play what you consider to be, what, too many shows probably, and it just wore you guys out. How does that happen? What's the reason for doing something like that? The management company itself, it makes more money that way, so they keep pushing you like that?
Well, we didn't have, it wasn't, our manager, he wasn't a company. He was his own guy.
Okay.
And basically what happened with us is it was too many shows just for the sake of getting out there and the sake of getting a show. And it was in conflict because he was also booking a majority of our shows as well, but he wasn't getting back to people. He wasn't returning phone calls. He was keeping us very regional. When we won the IBC in 2008, we should have broken out and been touring. And it wasn't until probably 2010 or 11 when we started putting out other CDs after we'd gotten rid of him that we started actually touring and having concentrated tours that made sense. And so it was just mismanagement in the sense that he wanted to keep us local because that's how he could keep us close and still make a bunch of money and not really have to do his job, basically. Until we got a manager that said, no, you need to play less shows and make them more meaningful, that we really saw how poorly that we had been managed for about 2.5, almost 3 years. And that's a very, very long time in the music industry.
Yeah, wow.
And then Tuff burns out, and then I'm starting over as a solo artist. And granted, I had a pretty decent fan base to start with, but all in all, I mean, nobody knows Danielle Nicole. They know Trampled Underfoot. Oh, Danielle from Trampled Underfoot.
Danielle, you mentioned your father, and on the new album, or the most recent album, Cry No More, you have a song about your late father. It's called Bobby. And you mentioned he was a musician in his own right. Let me play a little bit of the song first.
Bobby was a boy in an old man's suit.
trying so hard to fill his daddy's shoes. He never knew the man to his dying day. Went on in life with a price to pay.
Did you want to emulate your father when you were growing up as far as being in the music business or playing music?
My dad really let me fall into it and come to him as opposed to saying this is what you're going to do. But he was also a man of many vices and a chaotic childhood himself. So I wouldn't say that I necessarily wanted to emulate him, but I felt that music was my path pretty early on. And I've always even said if something happened and I couldn't play or sing anymore, then I would definitely want to produce or have a studio or record or write. There's no vision of my life or my life with my children that doesn't involve music. Huh. And I think that that's just something that is a direct result of my mom and dad loving music so much.
Stand up and say, it's my.
The song is called Bobby. It's from the album Cry No More from our guest Danielle Nicole on WGLT Sound Ideas. I want to play another song from this album that, you know, has a whole different vibe to it. The song is called Pusher Man.
It's late at night and you're alone. Find yourself reaching for the phone. You'll be crawling on your knees. Cause I got just what you need. I don't think you understand. I wanna be your pusher man.
Now this one has a feeling of I don't know if I want to say female empowerment, but it's certainly an empowerment song.
Well, this one I got the chance to write with a gentleman in Nashville by the name of Johnny Black. He writes a lot, produces a lot, plays a lot. Just a really cool human being, and he lives in Nashville, and I flew to Nashville to write with him, and he's like, well, I've got this idea for a song, but I don't know how you feel about it being a woman, you know. It's called Pusher Man, and it's about pushing your love. And he was like, would you be somebody that would be taken hold by a pusher man, or would you be the pusher man? I was like, I'd be it.
Yeah,
for
that's
sure.
What comes,
you know,
through.
I have no problem singing about being it, you know, going there. He had the hook, and he had, you know, he had the idea of the song Pusher Man and how it would start and a few of the lyrics. And then we sat there for 2 hours and then just wrote the song.
Wanna see it come my way at the end of the day. Cause I got the fix you need and the thing that you crave. I don't think you understand. You got yourself a pusher man.
When we went to record a few months later, I was like, here's this song. And Tony was like, cool, let's do it. And it was such a weird experience because, like, I love collaborative writing. But there's also, like, when you're writing with people that you already know or that you have a relationship with, you know, you don't want to write something stupid or get a little too personal with people that you already know. But there's something about writing with a complete stranger where it's really freeing because you're like, maybe it is a personal experience or maybe it's not, you know. So then you have that anonymity where I feel that you can just be as honest as you want to be.
Well, Danielle Nicole, it is so great to catch up with you, and thank you so much for sharing those stories. They're so personal and they're so passionate about it. It's great to talk to you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Danielle Nicole speaking with GLT's John Norton. Nicole will perform at the MSA Blues Concert, a fundraiser for the muscular dystrophy, multiple systems atrophy, rather. And that will be tomorrow night at Monarch Music Hall in Peoria. Trigger Happy and EC Scott are among a number of bands also performing. Discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Let's listen a little bit more to Danielle Nicole. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Ryan Denham, John Norton, Mike McCurdy, and Patrick Murphy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I want to be your pushing man.